John Mortimer presents The Trials of Marshall Hall. True stories from the archives of Britain's most celebrated criminal barrister, starring Tom Baker as Sir Edward Marshall Hall. A Death at Christmas. Introduced by John Mortimer.
It's always disturbing, even horrifying, when someone you know is accused of a serious crime. Perhaps a friend who'd always seemed sensible and affectionate. His friends thought the young ex-soldier Frederick Rothwell Holt, arrested for murder on Christmas morning 1919, quiet and dreamy. But what was he dreaming of? Even more terrible is the identity of the victim, for the woman found beaten and shot on the sandhills at St. Anne's-on-Sea is Holt's lover, Kitty Breeks. As the small town becomes certain of his guilt, many forget he'd just come home from a war in which he'd witnessed scenes of carnage unsurpassed in their horror.
No!
You're all right, mate.
No, get me out!
Oh, save!
No, please!
Sit tight now!
Wars end, dust settles, and bombs are forgotten by most, including Inspector Shannon of the Lancashire Constabulary, as he steps into the brightly decorated lobby of the Creningham Hotel on this Christmas morning.
Mr. Frederick Holt?
Yes?
My name is Inspector Shannon from St. Anne's Police Station. I'd be grateful if you'd accompany me to the station, sir.
And what for?
It's about the death of Miss Catherine Breek, sir.
What?
Would you mind?
Kitty?
Yes, sir.
Well, what happened?
Could you tell me when you last saw her?
2 days ago.
The 23rd?
We came up from Bradford together. I left her at the station.
What did you do yesterday?
I went shopping in the morning. Why, what's happened?
And yesterday evening?
I was at home with my father.
You didn't go out?
No. Well, I went out for a glass of beer. What is it? Why are you asking me
this? Miss Breeks was murdered, sir.
Yes, I see.
Do you own a revolver?
My God.
I have reason to believe that your revolver was used to kill Miss Breeks. I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder. Do you wish to say anything in answer to the charge? You're not obliged to say anything unless you wish to do so, but whatever you say will be taken down in writing and may be given in evidence.
Yes. Is that what you want? Right. Right you are, then.
Mustin?
Are you perfectly all right, sir?
Do you know what infuriates me to the point of madness?
Petty-minded judges, sir?
I'm not joking, Mustin. A certain human trait, stubbornness.
Stubbornness?
I refer to the crushing, endless, repetitive inability of some people to learn from experience. My daughter.
Ah, yes, sir.
What? Oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I have poured love and concern and all the powers of my protection into that child. Now she tells me she wants to go to Africa, to be a nurse in Africa, to help the African people. I should have said, are you ready for Africa? I could have said, is Africa ready for you? She wishes to do this in the company of a doctor whom she tells me... She says she is in love. I told her in the simplest terms I could find that at no time in her life thus far has she shown herself able to pursue an endeavour past tea time.
I see, sir.
And how does she respond? She tells me, with or without my blessing, she is going to Africa. And she will not speak to me. An old technique designed to bring me to my knees. It will not.
Sir Edward.
You and Mrs. Mostyn never had children?
No, sir.
Very wise.
Sir Edward.
Newton, I'm not interested.
Sir?
The brief you are carrying. I am not available to take it.
What have you done?
Not me. His daughter. His precious daughter.
Oh?
These sudden temper tantrums, they're getting worse. He's like a child.
Rebellion in the camp?
What is it?
What?
The brief you've got there.
He's not interested. You heard him.
Mr. Newton, after all these years...
Maybe I should see if Sir Archibald is available.
Where are you going, Newton?
About my business.
Leave the brief here.
But you said...
Leave the brief here.
Goodbye, Mr. Newton.
Well?
R versus Frederick Rothwell Holt.
Holt lies across a narrow bench in his cell at Strangeways Prison, a dark blanket draping on the floor. His eyes follow two insects climbing the wall.
Keep them away from me. I know what you're trying to do. You won't do it, do you hear?
What's the matter, Holt?
I know what you're trying.
What? What's that?
These flies. I know about them. I understand about them.
The flies, they're bothering me.
I know what it is you're up to with them.
Look, why don't you settle down?
They're carrying germs, aren't they?
Try and get some sleep. Why don't you do that?
They're American germs. They're fever germs. I know what's happening.
No, listen.
They're trying to kill me, but they won't. You know why?
I should just relax.
Because I understand about them, and when you understand, you're safe. You will not. You will not overcome me, do you hear? Because I know all about it!
Cold wind, sir.
Don't you like the seaside, Martin?
Not in winter, sir.
This is where they found a girl's body.
Yes, sir.
Where children play, club down from behind and shot three times as she lay. Pretty woman. You've seen the photograph?
Yes, sir.
And in love with our man, too. I've been given a pile of letters. Love letters.
Well, she was devoted to him.
It's a sad, sad business. But that's not all.
What else is there, sir?
If we can believe the letters...
Yes?
He was devoted to her as well. Come on.
Where, sir?
Let's go back and talk to Hope.
Mr. Holt, my name is Marshal Hall. I have been instructed to defend you.
Hall?
Yes. We need to go over the central arguments of our case.
Yes.
We need to establish more fully the alibi that your father provides.
Of course.
Is there anything you can add to your statement?
Yes, there is.
There is?
They're sending in flies through the grill.
Flies?
They're fever flies, as a matter of fact. If I turn my attention even for a moment, well, they're allowed in. The police conspire. Say the word dogs. See if you get a reaction. Then follow up and say, why do you permit bloodhounds to enter the prisoner's cell following a trail of paper?
Mr. Holt, I wonder...
A man in Bridlington has accused me of murder. Bridlington? This is the point. I've never even been to Bridlington. It's cool, isn't it? Well, use what you can. Cheer up.
Until the Homicide Act of 1957... English courts were guided in their treatment of possibly insane defendants by a set of questions known as the Macnaghten Rules. Did the accused know what he was doing? Did he know that what he was doing was wrong? Now in the taxi from prison, Marshal Hall begins to see these rules have all the flexibility of a straitjacket.
You've met the defendant, sir?
Poor fellow. To lose your reason. Terrible, isn't it, Newton?
Well, of course, I'm no expert.
Meaning what?
Just because a man acts mad...
Do you think he's fabricating?
I think it's possible.
No, the dogs, the flies, the conspiracy. He's mad. He shouldn't be standing trial.
All right, Sir Edward.
You've shown me how the opposition will argue, however. Yet we can't let him stand trial without some special plea.
Not guilty, then?
That's his choice. But he'll go to the gallows. Oh, that wretched man. What kind of a society executes its sick?
We plead insanity, then?
But what does that mean? We let him stand trial. We say he committed the murder but was insane, meaning he cannot appreciate the nature of his act.
Well...
The problem is, according to the Macnaghten Rules, there are degrees of insanity. And who can tell us what degree he is at? If the prosecution shows that his intellect is unimpaired, he may be judged responsible. It is the emotions which rule our conduct, not the intellect. It won't work. If I fail in the plea, he hangs. Newton, it must not happen.
The third choice, then?
Unfit to plead. We say we can take no instruction from him. He doesn't know what he's doing. It's the simple truth, after all.
Isn't there a tremendously high risk in that, sir? If we are overruled, then he is... launched immediately into a full trial in which the argument about his insanity will already have been rejected.
I am absolutely clear on that already, thank you, Newton.
I'm sorry, sir.
One day, Newton, we will have a judicial system capable of responding to the complexity of the human mind. But until that time, we are children, clumsy, ignorant children, crashing about in the china shop of the soul.
A heavy rain slashes down against the windows of Manchester Assize Court. Inside, under electric lights in the early afternoon, the jury is gathered to decide on Holt's ability to plead. In the witness box, a Captain Dawes of the War Office stands stiffly, awaiting Marshal Hall's questions.
Would you say the prisoner displayed symptoms of shock in relation to his experiences in the trenches?
Yes, sir. Lieutenant Holt was present at the bombardment of Fesubert. Soon after, he reported sick, and thereafter suffered from depression and loss of confidence.
Are these symptoms more commonly known as shell shock?
That is correct.
The questions continue, and when his turn comes, the Attorney General seeks to paint a different picture.
Have you ever known of anybody pretending to be shell-shocked in order to get out of the firing line?
Yes.
And were you initially convinced by these people?
On some occasions.
Would it not take some intelligence to fabricate the symptoms of shell-shock?
Successfully, yes.
To carry it off, yes, it would take intelligence. Would you say the prisoner is an intelligent man?
Yes, but I...
No further questions.
Dr. Smith, a pale, thin-faced man, an expert on the brain, is next to face the fire.
In your opinion, was the prisoner insane?
Yes, he was.
And would you say he is still insane?
Yes, I would.
And then the Attorney General...
Could we not say that the prisoner is a man of no little ingenuity, resource, boldness?
I don't understand what you mean.
I mean that of all the forms of insanity, is not delusional insanity the most easy to simulate?
He believes there is a conspiracy against him. The police send bloodhounds into his cell following a trail
of
paper.
We have heard all that.
What is more, he bears the facial appearance of a case of mental degeneracy. He has a narrow forehead. His eyes stand close together. And he has rather prominent ears.
Prominent ears? Are you saying that every Crown Court should be supplied with a pair of calipers in order to measure the protuberance of a prisoner's ears?
Gentlemen, my learned friend has implied the prisoner is behaving with guile. But the truth is, we do not know what the prisoner's opinion of this plea is. I am making it on his behalf. He has not asked me to make it. No matter that my learned friend mocks, my client was already suffering from the grievous shocks of his wartime experience and received a still greater shock on being charged with murder. So I ask you to find that he is not fit to plead.
But the prisoner seems to have lost interest. He looks at the clock. He yawns.
Foreman of the jury, you have considered the question put before you. How do you find?
We find the prisoner fit to plead.
Frederick Rothwell Holt, you are charged with the willful murder of Catherine Elsie Breeks. How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?
I am not guilty.
Sir Edward! Sir, won't you come in? It's raining, sir.
Go back to the hotel, Marston.
The case, sir.
Holt is a man who's seen too much.
I don't know what you mean, sir.
He returns from hell, yes. He finds a young woman, beautiful, loving, is blessed with love after the most appalling experiences. Blessed. Finds peace, takes it with both hands. They exchange letters, such love letters to break your heart. Tender, faithful, and loving. They plan a future together, and then, a sudden rage, jealousy, some who knows exactly why or what, some destructive voice within. And from a gentle, devoted lover, my dream boy, that's what she called him, he strikes her from behind, and as she lies in the sand, shoots her 3 times without mercy. What do you make of that?
Fairly credible.
That's right. Which means we don't wish to believe it, that the human heart hides more darkness than we can accept. Impossible? No, Marston. Merely unthinkable. They'll never forgive him.
Such turbulence is not reflected in the faces of the 12 jurymen, newly sworn in at the Manchester Assize Court. Confident of their duties, these citizens have come to assist at a process of law. Outside, a violent storm lashes at the windows, but in here there is only calm. Certainly the large policeman in the witness box looks calm enough with his notebook at the ready.
Inspector Shannon, who was first to discover the crime?
A fisherman, sir, early on the morning of the 24th of December.
And you were called to the scene?
Yes, sir.
What did you find there?
The body of a young woman, later identified as Miss Catherine Breeks. She was lying backwards on the sand. She was dead.
Was there any sign of a struggle?
No, sir. She looked as though she were asleep. I looked closer, and there was some blood around her head, and I noticed a wound on her chin and two other wounds on her body. There was also a severe injury to the top of her head.
The injury to the chin was later discovered to be the exit wound of a bullet which had entered behind her right ear. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
What else did you find?
There were footprints of a man's boot nearby. Evidently, the sole of the boot had recently been replaced.
It was new, you mean?
Yes.
And how far back were these boot prints evident?
Whoever wore them had accompanied Miss Breeks for some distance.
They were following her?
No, sir, they were with her.
Walking with her?
Yes, sir.
How would you interpret the wounds you saw?
Well, someone hit her from behind. She fell forward, and when she fell, he shot her 3 times.
You found Miss Breeks' purse as well, didn't you?
Yes, sir. It still contained money and a gold cigarette lighter together with some letters.
So you would rule out the motive of robbery?
Yes, sir.
Did you find anything else beside or near the body?
A pair of gloves, one of them bloodstained, and at a little distance a revolver.
Have you discovered to whom these gloves belonged?
To the prisoner.
And the revolver?
The prisoner.
Well, the Attorney General looks pleased with himself.
And so does his very good friend, the Inspector. See what we can do to disrupt this rather smug duo, shall we?
Inspector Shannon, were you accompanied by a colleague onto the sands?
Sergeant Brown.
In his evidence, he mentions nothing about the footprints accompanying those of Miss Breeks.
I don't understand.
He doesn't repeat your evidence about the footsteps.
It was my evidence.
I suppose this is etiquette between police officers, is it?
Sergeant Brown described footprints leading away from the body, which passed within half a yard of where the revolver was found.
How did you manage to identify those footprints as having been made by the prisoner?
After speaking to the prisoner, we went to his bedroom at his father's house.
You found some shoes there?
Yes.
Didn't the prisoner's father call your attention to the fact that the prisoner's shoes were dry and that the wet shoes you took away were not the ones his son had worn on the previous day?
No, sir, he did not say that to me.
He says he did. He says you ignored him. You tested the shoes, did you?
I took a tray of wet sand to the studio of a photographer and I took imprints of the prisoner's shoes.
And you photographed these prints and compared them to photographs you had taken on the sand?
Yes, sir.
Do you think they are a fair comparison?
I do.
Are you an expert in sand, Inspector?
I know what footprints look like.
Do you? When I look at these supposed footprints in the sand, I can see only indentations, depressions, and small ridges. Footprints? I don't think so. Did you see the prisoner when he was in confinement at the police station?
Yes, sir.
Did you hear him shouting in an excited way?
No, sir.
Did your colleague, Sergeant Brown, voice the opinion that the prisoner was, and I quote, a bit potty?
No, sir.
Tell us about the arrest of the prisoner, if you would.
I went to the Creningham Hotel.
Where the prisoner had reserved a table.
Yes.
A table for two.
So he told me.
He was waiting for Miss Breeks to arrive.
That's what he said.
A man's life is at stake, Inspector.
I'm aware of that, sir.
And you asked him to account for his movements on the previous day.
Yes. He told me he'd come by train with Miss Breeks, that they parted company at the station at Blackpool and he'd not seen her since. I asked him about some scratches on his right wrist and 4 scratches on his right cheek. He said he'd been scratched by a cat on his wrist and had cut himself shaving.
When did you make up your mind that Holt's statements about his movements were not true?
There and then.
Did you find a photograph of a man in Miss Breeks's purse?
Yes.
Did the police try to identify this man?
No, sir.
They didn't go looking for him?
No.
The Attorney General's next witness is a thin man in pebble glasses clutching a manila folder.
Mr. Greenbaum, you were the deceased woman's solicitor, is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
When did you see her last?
On December the 17th.
Why did she come to see you?
She wished to execute a will.
In whose favour is the will?
With the exception of £100, she wanted to leave everything to the prisoner.
A large sum of money?
Yes.
How much was that?
£5,000.
£5,000 to the prisoner. I see. Where was this money to come from?
She had recently begun a life insurance policy.
I see. Is it true that she had hoped to insure her life for an even larger sum?
Yes. She told me that they had tried.
They?
The prisoner and she had tried to insure her life for £10,000, but had been refused.
No further questions?
Gentlemen of the jury, you are face to face with a story which, if the theory of the prosecution is correct, deals with the most appalling crime it is possible to imagine. The prosecution asks you to believe that the prisoner met this beautiful woman after 2 years' sojourn in hell, that there rapidly grew a great affection between them, which ripened into intimacy. It was said that afterwards he devised his diabolical plan, that on the day of the murder induced her to go onto the sandhills between 9:30 and 10 at night, and there murdered her. All this, we are asked to believe, took place in a neighborhood where everybody knew him, where he had been a resident several years, where the police and tram drivers knew him, and where he must, if the prosecution is to be believed, have been hanging about for a couple of hours to murder her, and then to leave gloves and revolver and footmarks scattered around for all the world like calling cards. And then afterwards went back home with the certainty of detection. He must have known that letters from him were in her bag. He must have known that everyone in St. Anne's and Blackpool could have found out that his association with the woman was long-standing. The prisoner, according to the prosecution, left his little bag and scattered its contents in order to make any possibility of escape futile. The crime, I put it to you, gentlemen, the crime, by whomever it was committed by no sane man. The only thing that was real, and upon which everything in the prisoner's life hinged, was his devotion to this woman. Listen, gentlemen, listen to the letters in which these lovers poured out their hearts, and judge if their love was not true. Eric, darling, I want to put my arms around your neck.
I want to put my arms around your neck and kiss you when you are away. I feel so lonely. You know why. You are such a dear. I love you so very much.
And another.
Eric, dear, I cannot thank you nearly so much as I want for your extreme goodness to me. In my opinion, darling, you are the biggest and whitest man I know. I want you to get over just as soon as you can. No friends, just us.
Kitty!
Eric!
My dear, darling Catherine, you have no idea how lonely I feel without you, dearest. You love me. I love you. I feel I must always be near you. You are the one and only to me in this world.
How do you find the prisoner? Guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Sir?
Mostyn?
I packed, sir. The taxi's wet.
You did all you could.
Please, Mostyn.
Oh, and, your letter, sir.
Thank you.
Good news, I hope?
My wife tells me that my daughter has scarlet fever. She's given up the idea of going to Africa. Apparently her young doctor's gone without her.
By the way, will you be attending the Attorney General's dinner tonight, sir? I've been asked to reply.
No, Mostyn. Give him my apologies. I shall be going home.
Marshal Hall's appeal includes fresh evidence about two cases of insanity within Holt's family. He personally writes to the Home Secretary, Lord Birkenhead, who institutes a special inquiry into Holt's state of mind. But after their report, Birkenhead does not advise the King to use his prerogative of mercy. 2 years later, Marshal Hall sat on Lord Atkin's Committee on Insanity and Crime. The committee reported unanimously that there should be new legislation making what they called irresistible impulse a defence in law. However, their recommendations were overlooked. The old MacNaughton rules remained in place for a further 30 years. The next case also involves an ex-soldier, one who goes to great lengths to conceal his ownership of something as innocent as a bicycle. In the case of the Green Bicycle.
John Mortimer presented The Trials of Marshal Hall, dramatised by Michael Butt and directed by Michael Fox, with Tom Baker as Sir Edward Marshal Hall and featuring Derek Howard, Becky Hindley, John Hartley, Timothy Block, Jonathan Taffler and Robert Bly. The Trials of Marshal Hall is a Fiction Factory production for Radio 2.
And you can hear The Case of the Green Bicycle tomorrow here on Radio 4 Extra. Did Ronald Light shoot a woman cyclist dead? Marshal Hall sets out to prove he didn't. A few decades ago, the comedian Stuart Lee accidentally attended a free improvisation gig in which music was made using water, a balloon, a piano, and some amplified plants. It left him baffled, infuriated, and ultimately a huge fan of this divisive music form. On Radio 4 Extra, he talks to some of the scene's most influential musicians about what it means to play music with no rules and absolutely no idea what's coming next.
It's interesting that you can all be from different generations of improvisation, and yet there's a shared language that you can step up onto stage like that without having decided what's going to happen, and it will work, won't it?
But isn't it the same thing as saying that, you know, someone who's 5 years old can talk to someone who's 85 years old?
Yeah. Well, like to someone that's not familiar with this sort of thing, they would think, well, how's that going to work? Yeah. But it does work in exactly the way that you've just said.
Look, this is improvised now, this conversation, this dialogue. Yeah. But we learn a vocabulary, and sometimes we learn new languages, and the vocabulary expands, and we become fluent in it.
And we didn't decide what we were going to say before we started speaking,
exactly.
And yet it seems to be working.
Exactly.